Initiate Cowrat Podcast.
I just got this in the mail. Catan Dice Game.
Huh.
Which I'd never heard of, but I was looking up. Somebody said there was a two-player card game.
Right.
A Catan version. So I was looking it up, and I came across this on YouTube. I'm like, oh, just $5 on eBay, plus $5 shipping.
Traveling-sized Catan game.
Yeah, well, and it's a dice game. So there's no tiles. It's a score sheet and dice.
Yep.
And there's a tiny little map with 6 Catan tiles. So you do build roads and houses. You build all the stuff, but you just color in the things that you've built.
Oh, so the notepad's the consumable part then.
Right, you have to buy more notepads once you run out. But it's a little map with roads, and they're blank, they're white. Roads, settlement cities. And so you have to roll the combinations. Instead of have cards, you have to roll the right combinations. And you can re-roll 3 times and save dice out. And then there's a way to, like, exchange 2-for-1 or whatever. And each time you do something, it gives you points. So the most points at the end of the game wins. But I haven't actually played it yet, but I watched a couple of videos on how to play.
Huh.
Anyway, it looks fun. It was in my hand, and I thought, I'll bring it.
So what I did for fun this last week, I guess it was fun, was we had a lot of flooding, and there's been a lot of flooding in the Midwest in general.
That was not fun, right?
That wasn't the fun part, no. So with all the flooding, there was a historic dam in our location that's over 100 years old now that, despite what the misinformation that was just rampant out there, I couldn't believe it. Even on, like, Fox News and some other things I saw, I'm like, oh my goodness, the dam did not fail. Technically, it did not fail. It's still standing.
Right.
What happened is the river, because the dam was all plugged up with debris that should have been dealt with, that's my opinion, river overflowed the dam, which allowed it to catch the asphalt that's on one end of it. Once it cut into that, that's not actually part of the dam, that's just the approach to it. Then it just started chewing through the ground and cut its own channel.
Right, yeah, cut a big channel around the dam.
Bypassed the dam, yes. And claimed a house, and kind of by extension, but not literally, claimed a longtime local business restaurant that people are fond of. So that was sad. I was out there, 5 days last week, taking pictures of the progression of everything. And actually, I did a couple more stops in some other areas besides that one in particular. And then I made a photo book on Walgreens, which do not endorse their photo books, not the hardcover one, because what they do for the, call it the custom cover, is they basically print an 8.5x11 sticky sheet, or no, they use some kind of adhesive, I think they have to heat up, to bind it to the hard blank cover.
I see.
And there was bubbles in it, and they redid them a bunch of times, and not impressed. I mean, I realize that process is not cheap. It's like, you shouldn't even sell it, let alone even with a coupon, they were $30. A piece, and I was very disappointed.
Yeah.
Anyway, so shooting all these photos, just tracking an event, was fun. Sad, the outcome ultimately was very sad. But it's fun to photograph stuff like that because it has value to people, over time. Historic, it was unprecedented. We never had anything like that happen to that dam.
Yeah.
Despite all the flooding.
I actually saw a video. I feel weird because I feel like, gawking at someone else's tragedy. But part of me was like, why didn't you get a better video? But I actually saw a video somebody put on Facebook of the house actually falling.
Yeah.
Like the moment that it fell in the river.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you saw that. But
that happened an hour after we left. I mean, and I figured it would be something like that. But I'm like, I need to go home, get to bed, and go to work and stuff. I'm just not going to do it. But almost exactly an hour later, it went in. But he could tell it was going to. Just 10 minutes between two of my photos, they lost like 6 feet of ground that was holding the very corner up, and then now it was 6 feet of overhang.
Right.
There's lots of drones out there. There's lots of aircraft out there.
Right.
So a few people with cameras, but definitely be an event to have a drone for.
Right. You can get some nice shots that without being in danger.
Until they grounded them, which I think, I don't know if that was Tuesday night or Wednesday.
Oh, really?
So that they could, the county and maybe the new TV station, so they could have theirs up and not have to worry about the others. But
so is there anything specific photography-wise to getting something like that on camera? Because I know last time you talked about
specifics.
Keep getting prop planes and how you have to set
right? So on the two helos came by, you know, drop the shutter speed way down and adjust the other two settings so that you don't overexpose it with such a low shutter speed so you get a little bit of blur from the two helicopters. And then I have two identical bodies, so I was able to, you had to walk a fair ways to get down there, so I wasn't going to schlep my entire kit down there. So trying to pick which two lenses I figured I'd need. And after the very first morning out there, I was like, okay, yeah, I only need about this much length, and then it'd be nice to have something wider so you can get a, even you can build a panorama from multiple frames, which I did that too, off the bigger lens. It's nice to get just a simple wide one off of one frame. And then chasing debris down the rivers, and it was always a high contrast situation going out there in the evening. The sun's setting on the far side of the river, so you got all this backlight through the roof, so you do your best to shoot it as clean as you can so that you can avoid the highlights burning the image and raise the shadows a little bit, because I'm shooting raw mode all the time, so you got a little more latitude to make it the best of it you can.
It would have been a nicer photo op for you if the river had decided to go the other side of the dam. That would have been. So the sun wasn't behind.
No. Of course, in the morning it worked out.
Right, that's true.
Just then there was the whole thing of they had blocked off access on the west side, which is the side that the restaurant was on. They blocked off access way out at the main highway that went by, so you couldn't even get a shot from that angle at all for a reference. And then there was tons of cars. There's definitely plenty of gawkers.
Right.
Law enforcement. So here's just a reminder of taking pictures of things. I was out there just 2 weeks ago at the restaurant and ate there. And it had been a while, because as soon as all this happened, I dredged back through my photos looking for photos of the restaurant, especially indoor ones, to contribute to a couple of newspapers that I contribute as a freelance photographer to. And I didn't have as many as I'd like to have had, but I was just there 2 weeks ago and wish I'd have brought the camera with.
Right, yeah.
So anything around you that you could consider historic at all, even though there's no imminent danger or any situation like this, you don't know when this stuff's going to happen. Stuff like this happens.
Yeah.
If you're into photography at all, that's the key to getting the photo, is you have to be there first.
Right, yeah.
You have to be in the situation. You have to be on site.
And bring your camera.
You take it wherever you go.
It's funny, Linda, every once in a while I'll be going somewhere, she's like, should I bring my camera? And I've learned to say, yes, yeah. Bring the camera.
Right.
If you don't use it, fine, but bring it.
Exactly. Yep.
Because she has said more than once, oh, I should have brought my camera.
Yep.
So I'm curious, when did you get into photography and how?
I'll say this, and now this kind of doesn't matter anymore because of the pricing on everything and how many megapixels you can get for a couple $100 compared to when I first started. I wish I'd have started sooner, I'll say that. I got my first digital camera in 2000, and I wish I'd have gotten a better one right off the bat when I did, because that's the number one lament. Anytime I look at my older photos, it's like, yep, I got a photo, and it's about good enough to make A4x6 print from, and that's about it. So digital since 2000, and right off the bat, being in IT, I knew that part of the battle with digital, and I'll say that this makes it more complicated than film, is the whole backup thing, which I think I've commented on before, but it's just not that simple. As far as, you got your smartphone, you get a bunch of photos on it. Well, do you have an online, like with Apple, you use an iCloud, because you crash and burn on the phone and they're gone.
Right, yeah.
You should have them backed up to a computer at least. And ideally, they talk about the 3-2-1 backup scheme, which is three copies, two different kinds of media. That's awful. I can't name the first one, but but I've done that and managed to keep all my photos all the way back to 2000. I can still view them, still print them. I haven't lost any of them.
Right. Yeah, I know that Google does an auto backup of your photos.
Yeah.
And I suppose I should have seen this coming, but I started getting warnings of your free Google storage is full, you know, all email and docs and everything. And so I went out and deleted a bunch of stuff, and then a week later, it's still full. Like, ugh, like there's no way.
Yeah.
I'm sure half of it or more is probably stuff I could just delete because I don't care about anymore, but there's a time investment to try to figure out.
Yeah.
So then they said, or you can pay $2 a month, then we'll expand it by whatever. I'm like, I resisted that for a while and finally, like, fine.
You caved.
Right.
That's what they're hoping you'll do.
Right. Well, of course, it's a good business.
It's a convenience.
Right. And it's not that much.
Yep.
Of course, when's that going to go up?
And yeah. And you don't think that somebody like Google or Apple would go away so suddenly anytime soon, that you really got to be conscientious of, well, I don't really actually own that stuff. I mean, you read some of the terms on some of those, it's pretty draconian.
Right.
But it is a ton of work to take it into your own hands. So I mm-hmm. get it why most people don't do it that way. But if you want to have that photo in 30 years, it's going to take some work.
Right. And yeah, like you said, presumably Google's not going anywhere. And presumably they're not going to just disallow access to all your stuff. They're going to lose a lot of customers pretty quick, I guess. But you never know. And I'm assuming Google has multiple redundancy backups. So, you know, if an entire city burns to the ground, no files will be lost.
No files will be lost. No.
Right. I can't remember where I heard this, but it was on something I was listening to online. And this guy was saying he saw some Google data, you know, farm or whatever you want to call it, you know, rows and rows of buildings with computer backup stuff. I don't know the words.
Data center.
And there were some FBI were going in there, and the Google security escorted the FBI in.
Yeah.
And this guy was just pointing out, it seemed like Google has more power than the FBI.
I could go on for hours about that.
Right.
That whole thing. I'll say this, flash drives are not a suitable backup mechanism.
Yeah, right.
Anybody thinking they're going to buy a cheap 64 gig USB flash drive and thumb drive and store their photos on it, that is not at all a strategy.
I remember at one point I thought CDs, not DVD, that's for...
Oh, DVDs can be used for data too, which is what I use for but they're so small data-wise. I mean, they're not squat.
If you're
shooting JPEGs on your phone, you might be able to get a couple months worth on one of them. On a DVD, you might be able to get a year, but but if you shoot RAW or anything like that, really high res, you're out of space fast.
But I remember hearing, somehow in my head when I was younger, I thought, well, DVDs will last forever, right? Why would you question? But then remember hearing somebody talking about, everything decays over time. There's no way to preserve something forever.
Now, I'll say this, though, that DVDs are a lot lower maintenance than hard drives, which is what you have to go to. If you've got an enthusiast-sized library or bigger, you're going to be using hard drives. Those got to be refreshed. I think they figure about every 3 years is kind of the safe limit. If you're within that, you pretty much don't need to worry about it. Hmm. But DVDs, if they're stored properly, which basically means cool and dry, they'll last 10, 20 years. And actually at work, been through this scenario where we've got DVDs that are, I think what those oldest ones go back to, early 2000s. And they still work fine, and they're stored cool and dry.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is why they say for the 3-2-1 backup to have different media types.
Oh, yeah.
Is your hard disk and your DVD or some kind of optical. Now they've got M-disk, which is a lot higher capacity, and that actually etches into the material, and the material is, I forget how they describe what it's made out of, but it's not plastic. It's something more robust than that.
Mm.
That's a true archive format.
Mm. When did you first start becoming interested in photography? Was it before digital, or when you were a kid? Did you have a little camera as a kid or something? Or
I did have a little camera for a little while, and I've looked through the photos I shot back then, so I wouldn't say I was into it. And I was never in the photography class for yearbook in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Digital, pretty much because of the simplicity of it, it made it, you could see instantly what you had, so you could improve your craft a lot quicker. And there was a specific project. There was a construction project that kind of reshaped the neighborhood I grew up in. So I wanted to capture all this. So I got a lot of practice in a big hurry doing it. But I did have a film camera before that and had some issues with it that I never resolved. So digital just finally made the cost of emissions, so to speak, so much lower that then it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. It was when you first got your first digital camera that you really started getting into photography? Is that what you're
saying?
Right. Okay, got it.
I don't know if you can say anyone can be super serious without having an SLR, a DSLR, because of you can't change lenses, you can't, you're pretty limited. Not saying you can't make the most of a point and shoot, but there are limitations. So I didn't get my first DSLR till 2007. So I went 7 years with a point and shoot.
Oh, okay.
Three different point and shoots, actually.
But those are all digital cameras?
Those are all digital, yeah.
Okay, so what does DSLR mean?
Digital SLR, which is single lens reflex, like an old 35 millimeter, meaning you got the viewfinder. If you notice when you click the shutter, the viewfinder goes black because there's a mirror inside that flips from pointing the image from the lens through the viewfinder.
Oh, okay.
As the shutter opens. So that's single lens reflex, and the D is digital.
Okay.
So back in the day, all the 35 millimeter cameras are SLR, single lens reflex.
So is there something other than SLR?
Mm-hmm. Now the whole thing with mirrorless, that's the thing now. So they're doing an electronic shutter, which basically means they just turn the sensor, on and off, or they, I'm not sure how they do it. I really haven't read a lot on the specifics of how they actually accomplish it. But when you're looking through the viewfinder, you're actually looking at another small LCD screen showing you the image captured by the sensor.
Okay, got it. I feel like I just barely grasping what you're talking about.
And all the point and shoots before mirrorless, they were basically like an SLR. I mean, because you were looking through the lens when you look through the viewfinder.
Mm-hmm.
I had one point and shoot that I don't remember why that was the case with this one, but it actually had a electronic viewfinder, EVF.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a tiny screen inside there that you were looking at to show you the image.
Like, so I know on Linda's camera, you can look through the viewfinder or you can look at the screen.
Right. Kind of the part way in between, like mine are like that as well. You can use what Canon calls live view mode. So it shows it on the back of the screen. There's certain things you can't do in that mode, but that allows you, like for shooting video, you can set it on a tripod and actually see what you're doing. It's mm-hmm. like having a small monitor.
I see.
If you're using a tripod for doing still photography, that allows you, especially for like really telephoto shots, you know, 200, 300, 400, 600 millimeter shots,
mm-hmm.
you can do your focus and tweak all that on a tripod on the screen and be really positive of what you're getting, usually in manual focus mode. And then there's the touch screen, which is your wife's touch screen.
Mm-hmm.
If I had one that was touch screen right now, I'd probably have that disabled, right?
Oh, really?
It's useful for some things. I mean, specifically useful.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is the equipment you get familiar with. That's the stuff you're most effective, most proficient with, most
right.
productive with, at least at first.
Yeah, that's one thing that's irritating is when technology changes to the point where, like, I don't know how to use this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you really keep up on it.
Yeah.
But here's a question. Google, whoever makes phones, Apple, when you do updates on my phone, why do you move the buttons?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem better. It's just different. Why not
right.
leave it?
Right.
Please? Like, why do I have to relearn to use my phone after every update?
Yeah.
What are you changing that's making it better or more useful for the user?
Right. And I'll say the same thing about cars, where they've gone with the electronicifying, computerizing of cars. Okay, we've moved beyond what just helps performance and functionality in a meaningful rubber hits the road kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's just foolishness, some of it.
I remember hearing about the, I don't know if it was Tesla's, I don't know, years and years ago, that self-driving and, or they, something like the car is driving now, you have it on autopilot or whatever, but then all of a sudden the car would take off and go to 90 miles an hour and then the driver couldn't get control back.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, this isn't like a camera or a video game
right?
or a phone that you talk to. This is something your cars are dangerous.
You can kill people with
Who
this.
Can kill people with these?
Yeah.
How about a kill switch where it shuts the computer off? And it goes back to a car that was like 50 years ago.
Yeah.
It's just totally mechanical. You have fully control. The computer is off.
Yeah.
Why is there no big button that's, you know, boom?
Well, because they're doing stupid stuff like the gas pedal is just an electronic, it's just like a potentiometer or a sensor.
Right.
That tells the computer what to do to control the fuel. No link to the fuel system.
Right.
Steering is no mechanical link to the wheels.
Wow.
Yeah,
So, in other words, there is no kill switch. If you shut the computer off, there's no control.
Yeah.
It's not like either you have control or the computer does. Like,
no.
If you turn it off, nobody has control.
Correct.
Yeah.
On some vehicles.
Right.
Yep.
Whoa. So, the steering wheel and the pedals and everything, they're just making them look like the old ones. And
they're
feel
just
like
inputs. Yeah. Yeah.
Almost like a computer game.
Yeah. Now, granted, you can't do a self-driving car if that's your goal. You can't do a self-driving car without that because you have to be able to do everything that the user would do
mm-hmm.
without any user interface. So that gets rid of all the mechanical.
Yeah, I guess, unless you want to build some massive car where there's motors and pulleys and wheels that act like a human, like basically like a humanoid robot.
Yeah, right.
Turning the wheel for you. I was going to say, so it's kind of like a video game. Like it looks like a real steering wheel, but it's just pushing buttons on a computer in the background. Like my son, he saved up his lawn mowing money and bought a fairly expensive, I think, especially for like a gaming toy, but a steering wheel, brake pedals, and gear shifter.
Yep, for racing games.
Yep, for racing games. And I have to hold myself back. I could get hooked on that. That's pretty fun stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't, you know, obviously it doesn't feel like a real car, but for a video game, it's really good.
Yep.
And you got force feedback, which means there's motors inside the
steering wheel.
The steering wheel that if you hit a curb or a bumpy road, like the steering wheel starts fighting against you.
Yep.
And you got to push harder on it. So you kind of feel the terrain a little bit.
Yep.
So that's kind of cool. And it's funny, my two younger boys are getting into cars and motors and stuff. And my 14-year-old, he's like, oh, look, there's a such and such from whatever year going by. I'm like, how do you know this stuff? I've never known this stuff. If it's a car that I used to drive, then I know the make and model, but almost nothing else. So he's got the gear shifter. And so I'm trying to play this game, and my 12-year-old's trying to show me how to switch gears because I have no idea. I've never driven a stick shift.
That's theft control, yeah.
Yeah, right. That's true. There was some fair or carnival or something we were at, and they had a, I don't know, 100 or whatever year old fire truck that was still like drivable. The motor, they drove it in, and kids got up there and played around on it, and they, you know, they didn't let them drive it, of course. And the guy was explaining, he's like, just to get this thing started, you got to push this pedal down and turn this crank and then push this button and spin this thing or whatever. And he's like, there's 12 steps just to get the engine started.
Wow.
And he said, we don't need a key for this. No one knows how to start it unless you've got, you know, a couple of weeks of training.
Yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of memes about that whole thing about getting to the point where just driving a stick is theft prevention because nobody knows how to drive a stick anymore.
Same concept. There was a audiobook that I listened to. It was all science fiction short stories. So it takes place 2,000 years in the future. And some dignitary from another planet or star system or whatever was visiting this planet. And so they showed him to his hotel room, but it was an old-fashioned hotel room. And so they, you know, show him around. It was, you know, something like if we stayed in a hotel that looked like it was 100 years old, you know. That,
right.
That's fancy, you know.
Yeah.
And so he shuts the door, and then a little while later, he can't get out, and he makes a phone call. And I think this was written probably in the early 1900s, so they imagine what the future would be like, you know. Point being, he calls, and they come, and they can't get the door open, and they can't figure out how to open it. And so they call the maintenance guy, and he comes, he's like, this door is so old, I don't even know how it works. Like, the technology has been lost or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're calling everyone in the universe, and they finally find this guy who's 150 years old, and he's like, yeah, I think I remember my great-grandpa telling me something about it or whatever. And so he has to unlock the door for them because they don't know how the mechanism works.
Right. It's not that technology is bad and not that change is bad, but I forget where I saw it, but the point was made that just because something is new doesn't mean it's better.
Mm-hmm.
Just because something is old doesn't mean it's better. But the key question I always ask, especially with the cars, is what is the gain by making those changes? Because it adds expense, it adds complexity in getting them repaired,
mm-hmm.
it adds repairs that wouldn't even exist 20 years ago.
Right.
Because that's that mechanism, that system doesn't exist.
Right.
It's like, what is the gain? Ask yourself, what is the gain?
Right. Yeah. It's almost like I remember when I discovered Photoshop. Like, I just wanted to play with Photoshop and make stuff. But, like, what's the point? Like, I don't know. I'm just playing. And so I have to come up with something to use this software for.
Right.
Because it's so fun to use it. It's almost like,
just because we can.
Yeah. We've discovered this technology. We got to come up with something to use it on. So let's put it on a car, see what it does. Like, they're not thinking backwards. They want to use the technology, but they don't have a purpose for it. So they got to create a purposeless purpose in a way.
And then if you want to go tinfoil hat, you can say, well, it's all about control.
Yeah, I guess.
Because if you can shut down a vehicle anywhere, anytime.
That's a
anyway
thing I remember talking about when, I don't know, I was probably 13 years old. Like, wouldn't that be cool if cars could drive themselves? And some old guy be like, yeah, until the government taps into the controls, you know. Like,
exactly.
I guess.
Yep.
There was a meme on Facebook. It said, in the book 1984,
mm-hmm.
the government figures out how to get a camera in everyone's house and so it can watch and listen to everyone. And he said something like, 1984 got it wrong. They didn't realize that the citizens wouldn't have to be...
We'd ask for it.
The citizens wouldn't have to be pressured into putting these things in their house. We want it. Every time there's a new one, we go and buy it because we can't live without it.
Mm-hmm. There's one meme I saw that said, I can't remember, it was like 30 years ago, something about wiretapping on your phone.
Oh,
going,
yeah.
No, I don't want that. And then the next frame is, wiretap, get me a recipe for pumpkin bars,
right.
a.k.a. Alexa. Yes.
And when I really think about this stuff, like, okay, is this... I mean, I believe our government has some level of corruption. Surely you can't deny that. The question is how much, how fast is it getting worse. So I have no doubt that at some point the government is, if they're not already
right,
listening to what we say and have algorithms watching for red flags, you know, whatever. But I've thought, like, well, how do you get out of it? What? I guess you could move to a third world country. That'd be one option.
Yeah.
I mean, that might work for a while. I don't know. The other option is, oh, I know, I'll just throw my phone in the garbage and not have one. But if it ever got bad enough, that you'd have a knock on your door like, hey, we noticed that your cell phone has been off. Like,
for
oh, I don't have
months.
One. Oh, here's one from the government, complimentary. Yeah. Just yeah. Remember, don't turn it off.
Yeah, right. It's humanity. It's fallen. It's going to sin. It's right. Going to corrupt. And any mechanism, it's not the mechanism itself, it's the user, is going to be used, going to be corrupted and used for nefarious purposes.
Right. Just like the Bible says, they invent ways of doing evil.
Yeah, no fake.
Like, not only do we want to sin and do evil, we want new ways to do it. We're bored with the old ones. So back to photography. At one point, you know, Linda spent a bunch of money on a nice camera, you know, 20 years ago, whatever. And then my daughter went out and upgraded her phone. And then Linda realized
her phone,
this phone has better, like, all of the features of this camera are better than the camera that I bought,
mm-hmm.
this phone camera. So I guess the question is, if you can spend enough on a phone, is there any point to spending money on a camera?
It depends upon what all you're trying to shoot. There's still things that you can't do with the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to shoot action for any length of time in any seriousness with a phone, meaning you're not going to shoot baseball. You're not going to shoot somebody pitching, somebody hitting. You're not going to shoot basketball from the end of the court with a phone and get anything real specific, partly because zooming in and tracking through it and having the focus track it and all those kinds of things, at least not yet, is just that's
right.
just not going to happen.
Right.
They seem to be excelling at video at a disproportionate rate compared to still photography, compared to dedicated devices are, but not so you can't get decent results, and especially if you've got an app on your phone to shoot in RAW mode, which I do on mine just because white balance is almost always a problem. And the processing, in my opinion, that Apple does, especially the fake bokeh, the fake blur for the background, and the color, what they do to the skin, it just doesn't work if you do any editing to it. If you try to do anything with it other than just look at it online, it's just not going to hang.
I suppose, yeah. Of course, most things are online now.
Right. And so, I mean, it works for a lot of purposes, especially social media.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I'm still surprised that you see so much printed material. One thing I noticed is how many catalogs still get printed and how massive and heavy they are. And I was thinking about it one time. It's like, well, and most of them end up in the garbage. That's the thing that like made me scratch my head. Like, who is printing all these?
Who can afford to still print them?
Yeah. And so, and I thought about it, like, okay, so you got the guys cutting down trees to make paper. And you got the guys making the paper, and you got the guys making the ink, and the guys making the machines, the printers. You got the people running the printers, and then you got the trucks that are driving all this paper around before and after printing these. And then you got the people who deliver them into your mailbox or whatever. And most of them go in the garbage. And I thought, well, how is this whole thing, who is paying for all this? Most companies aren't going to keep running when they're not making money.
Yeah.
They can't.
Right.
They're going to shut down. And then I was talking to a friend who is a salesman, and he sends out mailing marketing stuff. And he said the industry standard when you're marketing through the mail is 2%. If you send out 100 flyers and you get 2 sales out of that, you've made a profit.
Huh.
After all, the, you know, if you pay for the printing and the shipping and whatever else is involved, you get 2 sales out of 100, you've earned money. It doesn't matter that 98 people just threw your flyer or whatever in the garbage. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So, of course, that is going to lead to thousands and millions of catalogs being printed, shipped, and go right in the garbage. Nobody looks at them.
Yeah.
Because they're getting the 2 or 3 or 4 people out of 100 that do purchase something. And so they're making a profit. So they're going to keep doing it. You know, I'm not a tree hugger, but it seems like a lot of waste.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously, online is just continuing to grow, and printing, I suppose, for marketing at least, is continuing to go away. You know, I know that there's...
Yeah, printing companies are having to adapt.
Like yeah.
My employer, yeah.
Right, yeah. And there's a printing shipping company in town that I knew of that recently, I don't know if they totally went out of business, they stopped their shipping services. That they had a partnership with the post office and they quit doing that.
Yeah.
I don't know all the details, but either way, I don't know if that's because of, you know, people just aren't using it as much. I guess that probably is it. But either way, like, just imagine still how much mail you get, how much, you know, printed advertising and newspapers and everything. I don't know if it's a fraction of what it used to be, but it's not.
Well, a lot with direct mail, like, you know, technology has really helped them, and all the data they're siphoning off you when you're on Facebook,
right?
Because you are the product. That's why Facebook's free. You are the product,
right?
The marketing to you and all that stuff, gathering this stuff so that companies can make very focused, targeted marketing campaigns, if they do invest in print, that probably greatly exceed the 2%, because they've already filtered down their data set to people. These are people that look at this kind of stuff. They're all these things. So that's still paying, but it's less of a shotgun approach and more of a sniper approach.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There was a story I heard. There was I think she was a teenage girl, and her dad saw in the mail, he got some, you know, junk mail advertising, whatever. And he was looking through it, and one of them had his daughter's name on it, so it was to her, and it was for, like, pregnancy products. And he just, like, flipped out, and he was like, "Are you kidding me?" So he went to the store, and I want to say the manager, like, "Why are you sending this junk to my daughter? Are you trying to encourage her to get pregnant or whatever? She's not even married," and whatever. And he's like, "Well, if we send it to her, it's because we have her on the list because she's bought something like this before. We don't send this stuff to everybody. We send it to people we know.
Yep.
We have some reason to think they're interested."
Yep.
And then so he went and talked to his daughter, and she's like, "Yes, okay, I'm pregnant. I didn't tell you yet."
Yep.
So this marketing, the store doing their marketing, is what tipped the dad off that she was pregnant.
Mm-hmm. That's about as bad as finding out about a relative's death on Facebook.
Yeah, right. So one thing I've noticed, I've never been into photography myself. And before I owned a camera, which is my phone, I've never gone out and bought a camera. I've bought a phone and it has a camera on it. I've never had an interest in trying to get something on film. I guess that's an old way to say it. Get a picture of something, a photograph. But now that I have one in my pocket, I see something and I'm like, "Oh, I should get a picture of that." And so you could say, in a sense, I don't consider myself being into photography, but I guess I'm sure that's a phenomenon that everyone, now that you have a phone in your pocket, a camera in your pocket connected to your phone.
And instead of taking notes, I mean, you see something, it's like, I take a picture of it, then I don't have to remember. I have all the information about it, like a box of a product at a store or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or, "Well, I need a fitting for this thing at home, but I can't bring it with." Take a picture of it on your phone.
Exactly.
Go to the hardware store, open it up. Okay, yep, that's what I need.
Yes, more than once I've gone to Menards and just showed someone a picture, either that I found online, because I didn't know what it was called, or took a picture of the thing at home and said, "Do you have one of these?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's very utilitarian, having the camera on the phone.
Right. One thing that I've seen a lot of people do is they'll take a picture of their receipt and then throw the receipt away.
Yeah.
And then they can, you know, text it to somebody if they want, for like their accountant or whatever. But I've definitely done that. I've taken pictures of signs or instructions, sometimes to zoom in on them because
can't see.
My dentist said I might need reading glasses.
Your dentist?
Yeah, I got a really weird dentist. He does a lot of stuff. No. The eye doctor. What's the word?
Optometrist.
Optometrist. Okay. It's not a word I use, I guess. Eye doctor is what I meant. Speaking of my dentist, that reminds me, I was at the dentist the other day, and he told me that I have to stop eating Hershey's bars. And I said, "What? Why do I have to stop eating Hershey's bars?" He said, "Because I'm trying to examine your teeth right now, and it's making it really hard."
No, that's like a Stephen Wright joke. I like my dental hygienist. I think she's really pretty. So in the waiting room waiting to get in, I'll eat an entire box of Oreo cookies, and she'll have to cancel all of her appointments for the rest of the day.
Our friend Jim has said more than once, he's like, "If I was a dentist, I would have free candy out in the lobby. I mean, that's job security for me."
Right? Yeah. I'm talking about that corruption in human nature.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Talking about cars earlier and corruption and business.
They are one in the same.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess. It just reminds me of a story I've heard more than once from Linda. First to me, and then, you know, to other people over there. And just recently, we were talking to someone about it because we had a surprise car repair that we needed while we were hundreds of miles from home. Took her car to a car repair shop, and I don't know what the issue was, but they said, "Okay, well, we got to replace this part. It's so many $100 for parts and labor, whatever." And so they did that. She paid it, drove it home, and it had the same problem. Nothing was changed. So she went back, And she said, the problem isn't fixed, but you charged me, so you're going to fix it with no extra charge? And they said, well, we literally did the labor, and we literally put a part in that costs money, so we're not doing free work. It's like, okay, but can you fix the problem? So then she said, well, my dad looked at it, and he said there's a sensor that's dirty, that might be causing the issue. Can we just clean the sensor? And they said, well, we're not allowed to do that. That's a very sensitive part, and if we break it, we'll have to replace it. It's like, well, so the other solution is just to replace it. And they said, yeah. It's like, well, can't we clean it first? And if it breaks, then replace it? And they said, well, we're not allowed to clean them because they're so sensitive.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly. So she took it home, and her dad cleaned it with an old toothbrush, and it worked and didn't have a problem for years after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I get it. Companies have policies. Their employees don't make the policies, whatever. But
policies, and what was it? I saw something about that. Policies have become the big, it's the... can't think of the word for it, but it's kind of like the big defense that companies hide behind to extort money from you.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that's our policy. The tire shops are classic. Oh, no, it's this much below there. Tread is this low. You have to replace all four of them.
Yeah, right.
If you got all-wheel drive, which I loathe that about owning an all-wheel drive.
Yeah.
But the reality is, after some situations I put the thing through, it's like, no, that's bogus.
Yeah,
right. There are extremes. I get it. It makes, mathematically, it makes sense. But mm-hmm. in real life, the tolerance is a lot looser than they try to sell you.
Yeah, right. And I have this love-hate relationship with, like, big corporations.
Yes.
It's like, on the one hand, they can get you the lowest prices. They buy everything in bulk. They got the manufacturing tightened down to a billionth of an inch of whatever. They can pump it out faster than anybody. They provide a lot of jobs. I don't know that the workers in most massive corporations are happy, but...
Right.
But they make a lot of stuff. They make it cheap. Everybody can own one now, whatever it is. But I've worked at small companies and I've worked at big companies, and they both have their upsides and downsides, I mm-hmm. guess, you know. It is nice when you can just, like, talk to the owner.
Yeah.
And he knows what's going on because he's there every day and he sees what you're dealing with. And
yeah.
He can make fast decisions like, let's just not do it that way anymore. Whereas a big corporation, it goes through levels of red tape and hierarchy and...
And all the managerial turf war things were like, right. Well, there's nothing in it for me to fight that fight, so I'm not going to fight that fight
exactly.
with my manager.
Yeah.
The Incredibles got it right with that scene with his InsuraCare. They're penetrating the bureaucracy. It's like, exactly.
Right. Where he knows which office she has to go to and what word
form.
She has to say to get, or what form
yep.
to get what she needs, but he's not allowed to say it because it's not good for the company.
Yeah.
So he's like, well, if I were to tell you to go into office, whatever, and if I were to tell you, like,
talk to Norma Wilcox.
Right. But you didn't hear from me.
I know you're upset. Yeah, no, that was classic. That is all too real.
This is kind of a flip situation. It was the customer was causing the problem. But my brother told me the story. He worked at Godfather's Pizza.
Mm.
And there was one Godfather's Pizza in our town and one in the sister town right across the river. And they had a policy they don't deliver to the other town.
Right.
Which I think makes sense.
Right.
I mean, it might be nice, like, if you live on the edge of town and you're actually closer to the other one, maybe, but whatever.
Right.
Either way, that was their policy, which made sense. So his boss answered the phone, and this lady wanted a pizza delivery. Oh, what's your address? And he said, well, sorry, you have to call the other store. We don't deliver to your town. And she's like, well, I called you, and I wanted whatever. And she got all upset about it. And he listened for a minute or whatever, and he says, okay, I'm going to go out of my way to help you here. Possibly putting my own job at risk. Don't tell anyone I gave you this information. But if you call this number, they will get you what you need. And he gave her the number for the other store. It's like, oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my word. Yeah, and some people are just like that. And that's not any better than the corruption. That's a different kind of corruption.
Yeah, right. I've worked in customer service, and it's made me a better customer because I know what the other side is dealing with. Like, yes, I know you're upset. I know that we should fix the problem. And I don't say, well, look, ma'am, I don't make the policy. Nobody wants to hear that. That's not helpful. It doesn't, like, I don't say that when I'm talking to a customer. It's true. But really, I think where that comes from is I don't like the fact that you're yelling at me. Now you're offending me. Like, when you're in customer service, you can't be offended. That doesn't help. Like, sometimes I can't fix the problem, but it doesn't help to say, well, I can't do it. I'm not in charge. Tell me who is then. Whatever, you know.
Right.
So as the customer, though, I went to a pizza ranch.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true, but Pizza Ranch showed up. Godfather's closed.
It's been shrinking for a while. There's very few locations in the state.
Yeah. I'm sure Pizza Ranch didn't help Godfather's stay in business.
No.
Because didn't they, in our town, didn't they go right next door? There are some companies that is their strategy.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
go next door to their competitor
right.
every time.
Like
every
CVS
time.
Diagonally across from Walgreens, yes.
Right. I've noticed Hardee's always seems to go right next to a McDonald's.
Yeah.
Home Depot next to Menards.
Although that's a strategy, and that's why Lowe's, one reason anyway, why they totally blew in town here, because they weren't anywhere near all the other three home improvement stores were all right next to each other.
Right.
And they built in a totally different part of town.
And it seems like it could be a double-edged sword. Like one of my kids is like, why do they go right next to their competitor? Won't they lose business to the competitor? I'm like, or their competitor loses business to them.
Yeah. If they're out, they're right next door, they're convenient, they're going to come to you.
Mm-hmm.
Car dealerships are huge that way. They always want to be in bunches.
Right.
Because that way people who are out looking for cars, they're more likely to come by your place and also check yours out because you're right there.
Right, exactly.
So they can, it's like the full shopping experience all in one go.
Right.
Without having to, you know, drive a million miles.
And if one area of town is known for that's where you can buy such and such, like, mm-hmm. well, then you probably better be there if you sell that, if that's your main product.
Yep.
And there's definitely been times I go to McDonald's. It was impressed on me as a kid that McDonald's is the place you go for cheap, yummy food. But there's been times where I go, you know, I'm on my lunch break and I see there's 38 cars in the drive-thru for McDonald's and two for Hardee's. I'm like, I guess I'm going to Hardee's.
Mm-hmm.
So they've gotten some of my business because they're next to McDonald's.
Right.
But I also noticed it seems like Hardee's can serve two people in the time it takes McDonald's to serve 10 sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe I got to judge, like, okay, is it really going to be faster?
Right.
So I was at Pizza Ranch for Father's Day. We went there a few years ago, and they gave me a coupon. They said, all dads get a coupon for one free meal. And of course, I get it. They want you to come back with the whole family at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I don't like falling for coupon deals because, like, is this going to end up costing me more money than I would have spent if I didn't have a coupon? Most of the times, yes, so I just throw it away. But I thought, well, there's no rule that I have to bring someone with me.
Right. So, exactly. I don't have to fall for that guilt trip.
Right. So I went on my lunch break one day just myself. Oh, so when I was there on Father's Day, their ice cream machine was down. So they went and bought some, like, shaved ice treats from some other store.
Yeah.
And they were handing those out. So they were still serving their customers. Like, we got something, a frozen treat for you. And they were individually wrapped things, you know. It's like, yeah, but I want ice cream. I didn't want shaved ice. So I'm like, whatever. It's fine. I got a shaved ice treat. Then, so of course, it was like about maybe a week later that I went again with this free coupon. And the ice cream machine was still broken. And so there was a waitress walking by, and I almost said, excuse me, ma'am, do you know when the ice cream machine is going to be working again? And I stopped myself, and I thought, how would I feel if I was in her shoes? I'd probably say something, or at least be thinking something like, look, dude, you're the 100th person who's asked me today. It's not my job to get that machine fixed. The manager doesn't know when it's going to be fixed. We're waiting on a part. Why do you people keep asking me that?
Yeah.
Also, you asking me isn't going to get you your ice cream.
Yeah.
It's not going to be done in 5 minutes, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
So I just said nothing because, again, asking wasn't going to get me what I wanted.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to make me feel better or get me my ice cream.
One thing companies have gone to in customer service that just drives me up a tree is this empathy model where...
Mm.
Oh, yes, I understand. I'm sorry about whatever. I'm sorry that's happened to you, whatever. It's like, you know what? You just wasted 5 seconds right there giving me nothing useful. And a lot of times it's a technical thing related to something at work. It's like, look, bottom line is just tell me, do you know, is there a bug with this right now? Is there a known issue with this? Just tell me straight out. Then we can get to it and you can tell me what to do with it, deal with it. Or you can tell me, no, we know it. There's a fix that's in beta, but we don't have it right now. Great. Thanks. I mean, the empathy thing, I understand why companies went to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're thinking it's maybe taking a little bit of the heat off of people,
right.
Customers chewing the ears off of the phone people.
Mm-hmm.
But that drives me nuts.
Yeah.
It's completely useless.
When I did my graphic design freelancing for a little while, I read some marketing books. And I feel like, it's possible for these large corporations that's so hard to do customer service, right? I think it's actually possible to do it. First, I get it. Yeah, it costs money. Yeah, that's true. Rick just gave me the sign, universal sign language for cash, rubbing your fingers together.
Yes.
But some companies, I think, they got a handle on it pretty well. There's at least some things you can do. Like, hey, no other company's doing this. Why? Like, this seems so simple. But one of them, it was some store, I think. And so at every station where there could be a customer, they had like a red button installed. And the policy was every time a customer didn't get what they were wanting, for whatever, it didn't matter the reason, like you push that button and it would put it into the computer, like what station was it at, what time, and a customer didn't get what they wanted. And so they could like try to figure out where are the problems and what's the issue. We want to at least know every time a customer is unsatisfied. And my thought is like, record how many times your customer service employees say, oh, it's just the policy, ma'am. Like, try and figure out how to make that better.
Yeah, make that go away.
Yeah, right. Because, again, I don't think that's ever satisfied a customer. Like, oh, now I understand. It's your policy to treat the customers badly.
Right. Yeah, some companies, I think, statistically like to flirt with that ditch on the whole road of, well, we don't want to invest too much in customer service because we'll still get their business anyway. You know?
Yeah, right.
That's not exactly what they would say, but that's what ends up coming down to is no customer service. If it isn't happening, then we're not going to have customers at some point.
Mm-hmm.
They get so blind to got to have profits. And that's where the whole thing of investments, I get it, because you have the whole 401k thing, all these different investments. People want to be able to make money investing for retirement. So that ends up being the motivating thing for all these gigantic corporations. Well, that's also the thing that drives them to make cuts and do ridiculous things like they do with customer service to make it a nightmare to deal with them. They just manage to keep the noise down enough that they stay in business, but
right,
it's all over that. I mean, it still comes down to pretty much the almighty dollar, which commerce is good. It's a shame the lengths it kind of goes to and how it practically impacts you sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was in one of these books, there was another story, this guy who would, he would make and sell donuts, and he just had a little donut stand. It was just him in front of a bunch of big office buildings. So in the morning, people on their way to work would stop and grab a donut and then go into work. It was right there. And he started to realize that he was losing customers because he literally could not serve them fast enough. There was too many customers in line, then they'd be looking at their watches, like, oh, time to go to work. And so he realized he was losing time making change because he only dealt in cash.
Oh, yeah.
And so he thought, well, make your own change. So he just had a box there, and you know, he would basically stand there and grab your donut, put your change in there, or he'd hand him the donut, whatever. But he wouldn't mess with the change. He'd move down the line, and there's a cash box. Put your $10 bill or what, your $5, whatever, take out your change. And so he thought he'd try this, and he'd noticed two things. One, money would be missing. Say he charges $1 a donut. He sold 10 donuts, but he only had $9 profit. But he used to sell 2 donuts a day. Now he was selling 10, but earning the profits on 9 because somebody didn't make the right change.
Yeah.
So overall, his daily income went up for the same amount of hours because he realized that most people are honest. There's a few characters out there that probably, like, you could just be counting wrong by accident, whatever. But if somebody cheated him, he made far over compensated for the number of customers total that he was selling to. And so he thought, fine, 2 or 3 people are going to steal from me. I'm still getting a bigger paycheck at the end of the day. And the customers were happier because the line was moving quicker.
Yeah.
People that weren't standing in a line for 10 minutes and didn't get their donut because they didn't have time.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I have this concept, and again, I did the freelancing thing, but I've never run a big corporation or whatever. But I've always thought, like, give the customers the benefit of the doubt, give them the refund, whether they truly deserve it or not, you know. I do think most people are honest, and if you treat your customers like they're probably lying to you when they have a problem.
Right.
You know, like, why do I have to prove myself? You guys are the ones who screwed up. Like,
right.
Why do I have to prove it, you know? So, yes, there's a danger if somebody's going to take advantage of you, but my assumption is most of your customers are going to be happy and say, this is the best. Their customer service is just the best. I never have to fight with them or argue with them to get the problem solved. They just solve it.
Yep.
And I don't have to prove my receipt and what day was I there and all this. So, and they'll lose a few dollars to people who want to scam them.
They'll probably gain in loyalty.
Yeah, they'll gain customer loyalty and they'll get referrals.
Yeah.
People will tell them how great their customer service is.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Yeah, that's the word. And again, I don't know. It's an idea in my mind whether how well that would work in real life. I don't know. You know, when I was younger, I would complain a lot about, why doesn't the management do this? Why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? And I still do that sometimes. But to me, it's kind of like complaining about, why did God do it this way? Like, well, I'm not God, so...
Yeah.
Could I do better? Probably not.
Right.
And when you're complaining about your boss, you're complaining, probably complaining about somebody doing their job that you've never done before.
Yeah.
So there's things that they have to deal with out of their control. Kind of reminds me of the Dave Ramsey. He, obviously, his personal finance is his main thing that he talks about, but he also talks about how to run a business because he runs one.
Mm-hmm.
And he, one of the things I've heard him say a lot to like other business owners, because a lot of times people will call his show with financial questions, but they also run a business and they often have the business finances they have questions on. But he's often said he uses the golden rule when working with partner businesses or vendors or customers when trying to decide, like, what is the right thing to do in this situation if there's an issue or how shall I treat my customer? You want to make money, but you want to do what's right. And sometimes those clash. Mm-hmm. I can definitely make more money if I do it this way. But and he just says, if I were him, how would I want to be treated?
Right.
Do that. Don't question it. If you were the other guy in this transaction, would you be happy if the other guy did it this way?
Mm-hmm.
No, don't do it that way.
Right.
Yes, do it that way. It's such a, I feel like it's such a simple concept.
Right.
Like you can do it with your wife, with your friend, with your boss, with your customers, with a stranger on the street. Put yourself in their place. Would I appreciate if they did that to me? Then do that.